From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a through line in Barack Goodman's documentary airing tonight on the PBS program American Experience. The film is about the 1992 shootout and siege at Ruby Ridge in northern Idaho, where Randy Weaver's wife and son were killed along with a federal marshal. There's a connection between Ruby Ridge and the Oklahoma City bombing and the Branch Davidian standoff in Waco, Texas, where you have people with extreme views in conflict with the federal government with disastrous results. But Goodman's film is less interested in laying blame as trying to figure out, as someone puts it in the documentary, how an all-American family from Iowa ends up with these beliefs that make the government treat them like armed terrorists. Goodman is joining us today to talk about the lessons of Ruby Ridge after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The filmmaker Barack Goodman's documentary about the Oklahoma City bombing premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival, and in it, he traces the country's emerging white supremacist movement. The Ruby Ridge story is an important part of that history. Randy Weaver's standoff with the federal government, where his wife and son were killed in 1992, was an important symbol for the movement. And Goodman has said, if you want to understand the rise of the white nationalist movement, you also have to look at Ruby Ridge, but he came to believe the Ruby Ridge story should stand alone. So he's made another film, a kind of companion to the Oklahoma City documentary. It's airing tonight across the country in the PBS program American Experience, and Barack Goodman is joining us today to talk about it. He directed, co-wrote, and co-produced the film. It's called Ruby Ridge. We'll give you some details about airings a little bit later on the program. Barack Goodman is joining us today from a studio in New York City, and Barack Goodman, welcome to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin with the point at which you figured this. We need to make this a separate film. It can't just be part of the Oklahoma City bombing documentary. It needs to be its own thing. At what point did you sort of figure that out?
Pretty early on, we had a cut of our Oklahoma City documentary that was very long and included basically an hour on Ruby Ridge, an hour on the Waco Branch Davidian tragedy, and then an hour looking at the Oklahoma City bombing and the investigation. And clearly was we were losing the thread of what we were trying to say in the Oklahoma City film. But we had these very rich characters, these wonderful interviews with some of the participants in Ruby Ridge. And my executive producer and myself just talked about what are we going to do with this material? It's so rich. It's such a wonderful kind of narrative. And we shouldn't leave it on the cutting room floor. So he was, gracious enough to find room on the schedule on American Experience to have a whole hour simply on Ruby Ridge. And one more thing about that, it really felt like a different film than the Oklahoma City film. It felt like it engaged different questions, and it was really not a repetition of what we were saying in Oklahoma City, but a very different kind of look.
It's interesting. That's absolutely right, at least from my perspective seeing the film. Apart from its broader connection to the story of white nationalist movement or whatever, it seems like this is almost more just about tragic timing and, right, and how close they could have come in this story to averting the worst. But then the decision was made on both sides, just the worst possible decisions. It seems like it's almost as much about that as anything.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a parable. I really feel like it's a kind of almost a sort of case study in decision making and how that can go wrong on both sides. I think that's important to emphasize, that while the federal government certainly made a series of disastrous missteps in this case, the decisions made by the Weaver family, and particularly with Randy Weaver himself, were also self-destructive and disastrous. And I think that's really the takeaway of the film. As someone has said to me, it's really about conspiracy thinking itself and how when each side in a conflict invests the other with a kind of almost superhuman power, sort of menace, things can go very wrong. And I think that this is a parable of that dynamic.
Someone said early in the film that it's like a locomotive. And once you get something like this started, it's almost impossible to stop it.
It is. And yet there are, as you said, points during the story where it's easy to see how a different course might have led to a much happier ending.
Right.
And it's frustrating almost to witness the sort of downward spiral of this story and all the avoidable mistakes. But in those mistakes, you really can see how, you know, how this sort of gets out of control and gets away from people.
We should begin with something expressed by Jess Walter in the film. He's a writer. He had reported on the story when it happened. And he said that the most interesting part of the story for him wasn't, you know, who's to blame necessarily, but how it is that this all-American family from Iowa ended up with these extreme beliefs. So let's start there. How do you describe the Weaver family, you know, before they end up on a mountaintop cabin in Idaho?
So the Weavers were very definitely an all-American family. They came from Iowa. They were very close with each other. Vicki Weaver in particular, and to some degree her husband Randy, developed very strong religious beliefs. And they had a kind of Old Testament character to them. Vicki came to believe very strongly in a coming apocalypse. She was influenced in particular by a novel she read. But it really was for her inevitable that there would be an enormous conflagration between the forces of good and the forces of evil. And the only recourse for herself and her family was to escape to a kind of remote area. In this case, it was the northern part of Idaho, to a mountaintop in Idaho. And she found biblical references that seemed to confirm this for her. And various events that happened during their time in Iowa only seemed to sort of confirm for her the inevitability of this Armageddon. So the family removed to this small mountaintop cabin and, you know, really kind of were there to wait out the coming war. But what happened was that Randy, in particular, began to flirt with extremist right ideas, organizations, in particular one called the Aryan Nations, which was about 60 miles away from their cabin in Ruby Ridge. And it was there that he came to the attention of the federal authorities. So he was never himself a dyed-in-the-wool white supremacist, but he did clearly, and the family in general, clearly flirted with those ideas. They would call themselves white separatists.
Right.
And that's where he began to get himself in trouble.
Let me play a moment from the film. Here's the writer Stuart Wright in the film talking about how, as you say, Weaver wasn't necessarily drawn to northern Idaho because of his ideas about race. But it kind of got social for him.
I don't know that Randy Weaver knew at the time that they moved to Ruby Ridge that they would be so close to the Aryan Nations compound, which was just 60 miles south. But they started showing up. At first, it was purely social. They attended family picnics and those kinds of things. But as Randy began to interact more with them, he started to buy into the message.
We, the white race, lost the war. A plague known as Jews won the war. Infiltrated our bloodstream of our race in every country in which we reside.
Now, some people may recognize that last voice there. That was, of course, the white supremacist leader, Richard Butler. He was a pretty vocal racist and separatist during that time. Talk about how this Christian identity theology, that you saw a lot of that in northern Idaho at the time, because mm-hmm. you work through it a little bit in the film. Like, what was it? What was the dogma, I guess, the doctrine that they were all working out up there?
Well, it's a very old and very strange corruption of Christianity, which sort of holds the belief that basically the Jewish people are descended from from, you know, a corrupted wing of Christianity, from Cain, and that the true chosen people, the real Jews, as it were, are actually European white Christians. Yeah. And so, you know, it's all been twisted around in their minds, and the Jews as the chosen people is an abomination, and Jews are actually lesser people. And in that same calculus, people of color are not even human. They're called mud people or beasts. It's basically retrofitting a racist, white supremacist point of view onto Christianity, finding a biblical justification for these beliefs. And it had surprisingly a lot of resonance and a lot of acceptance, particularly in the Northwest during that time, where a lot of people had come to, you know, find like-minded people, even to establish a whites-only homeland there. And I don't think that Randy Weaver himself, or certainly Vicky, ever totally embraced this point of view. But this was the point of view they were exposed to at Aryan Nations. Aryan Nations was Richard Butler's compound and became a clearinghouse for a lot of white supremacist, neo-Nazi, you know, Ku Klux Klan groups. At the time, they were trying to build a kind of a movement. They were trying to build a consensus among a lot of disparate groups with this Christian identity as a kind of theological spine for it.
It seems like Randy Weaver's arriving in northern Idaho was just, and also in some way, kind of really bad timing. I mean, he shows up as things are getting really tense. The federal government is starting to pay attention to these groups. Here's another moment from the film. You'll hear Jim Botting. He's a negotiator for the FBI. Also hear the journalist Bill Moreland.
Some people who had spent time with Butler up at Hayden Lake would go off in these splinter groups that became threats in their own way. They were very violent, very anti-government, were heavily armed. So the Aryan Nation was a cause for concern for those of us in law enforcement.
Starting in the mid-80s, the feds wanted to know who's there, and what are they doing, and what are they planning on doing next? So by the time Randy Weaver started showing up at the compound, the feds were listening.
It's almost like he stumbled into this terrible situation almost.
He did. It was terrible timing on his part. Essentially, what had happened in the previous few years was that a splinter organization kind of arising out of the Aryan Nations called the Order had been perpetrating a series of really violent crimes in the Pacific Northwest. This was really the first domestic paramilitary terrorism organization on the far right, much more organized and sort of determined than, for example, the Weather Underground had been in the 60s on the left. These were really well-trained and very determined bad actors. They had murdered a Denver talk show host who was a Jewish man. They had committed a series of armed robberies, including one very spectacular one in Ukiah, California, that netted them millions of dollars, which they disseminated throughout their movement. So the FBI, which at first had ignored them or not known about them, by this time was extremely interested in what was going on at Aryan Nations. Someone joked to us at one point that there were so many undercover agents at Aryan Nations that they ended up talking to each other more than they did actual members of Aryan Nations. So when Randy shows up, they see a guy that's a good target to flip. They believed it correctly that he was not a firm believer in this stuff, that he might be able to be kind of shaken loose, and yet he was interested enough and present enough at Aryan Nations that he could actually do some good work as an undercover agent. And that's what set in motion the FBI's interest in Randy Weaver.
It's interesting. He, at the behest of an informant, saws off some barrels on some shotguns, which is a federal offense.
Right.
And I can't quite figure out, Barrett Goodman, is this entrapment? I mean, it seems like like you don't really work that through, and I'm not sure how crucial it is to the story, but it did seem like it was Randy Weaver's idea.
It was pretty clearly entrapment. And we have the ATF, who was conducting this operation initially, tape recorded and transcribed many of the meetings between their undercover agent. He was actually an informant rather than an agent, but him and Randy and another character. But the actual moment that Randy agrees to soft the shotguns is mysteriously lost. Nevertheless, it's quite clear, and Jess Walter makes this point in the film, that Randy was entrapped. He had no independent experience or interest in sawing off shotguns. The informant asked him if he would saw off these shotguns, knowing that that the Weavers in general were very desperate for money and that Randy in particular needed a job. Apparently, I'm told if Randy had sawed off the shotgun some millimeters less than he did, it would have been legal. Mm. So it was a very iffy set of charges brought against Randy, but enough. It was clearly enough to scare him into either becoming an informant or doing what he did, which is basically becoming a fugitive.
You talked to Chuck Peterson in the film. He's an attorney who represented Randy Weaver's children. He's a defense attorney, and he explains in the film sort of how they got to this impasse.
Here's the government, and they come to you and they say, "We've been watching you. We know that you sold a sawed-off shotgun. Now, if you won't work for us, if you won't help us to get inside the Aryan Nations and to get inside the white separatist movement, if you won't do those things for us, then we're going to arrest you, and we're going to place you in jail, and we're going to take away your property." And Randy Weaver said no.
That was one of those moments, I guess, right, where things could have turned.
They could have. And this is a complex and interesting, you know, turn here, because basically, Randy was misinformed that by a federal magistrate who later admitted this, that if he lost his case, he would lose his property.
Right.
And for him, that was everything. That's all they had, the Weavers. And this was perhaps the most important reason that he then missed his court date, refused to come down and face the music, as it were, and instead retreated up to his mountaintop cabin with his family and a lot of guns and ammunition.
We should say something about that compound. And I'm wondering, we see images of it, contemporary images, news video, those kinds of things. But I'm wondering, we also see images... did you go there, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. Did you go up there?
We did go up there. Sarah Weaver, who's an important character in the film, the eldest daughter of the Weaver family, still, and she and her sister still own that property. And so we had this very memorable afternoon where she took us up. The only way to get up there is on very sturdy three-wheel vehicles. And it's a jolting ride up very steep, sort of rutted path. And as we got close to the top, she kind of halted the caravan we were on and jumped out. And we saw that she was heading to this sort of pile of trash. It looked like just a big pile of trash. And when she got over there, she started picking up little items, a little boy's jacket, a little part of a stove, a little, you know, this and that. And she was tears were streaming down her face, and it was immediately obvious that this was a kind of what was left of one of the buildings up there, one of the little tiny little shacks that they'd built up there. And these were all the, you know, original items from that shack, and no one had been up there to take them down. Sarah very, very rarely, I think she's been up there a couple of times since this happened. It's too painful for her to go up there. And this was, you know, that moment that she was reliving those, you know, years up there that she'd spent with her family. So, you know, that was an incredibly emotional moment. But in general, you know, all that's left up there is a foundation, a few items of old clothing and furniture, and basically that's it.
It was kind of idyllic if you were a kid. I mean, they had a garden. They were outdoors exploring. Sarah talks about how kind of great it was.
Yeah, for a kid, it was she says both. It was a wonderful way of life. She and her brother and sister, and then later an infant that came along, right, were very, very close to each other. They were each other's best friends. They spent their days reading and being homeschooled by their mother. It was also hard. Yeah. There was no electricity, no running water. The long winters.
Yeah.
The winters were brutal, yeah, up there. You can imagine with their little slats for, you know, no insulation. So it was both things. But one thing that you clearly understand from Sarah about the Weavers is how totally loyal they were to each other, how they would never question anything that their parents said, and how much they loved each other.
January of, I think it was 1991, Randy Weaver is arrested. And Sarah talks about this, how her parents, their faces were pushed in the snow. Randy's carted off to jail. He's booked and then eventually released, facing these weapon charges. And things seem pretty desperate at this point, seemed like, for the Weavers. I mean, they felt like they had nothing to lose.
It's also very important to understand how they regarded the government. They had imbibed enough of this far-right ideology mixed with their own biblical sort of point of view to come to believe that the federal government was not only just evil but was really bent on their destruction.
Right.
So it's less of a leap to understand why they would do something like defy the government and head up to their cabin if you understand their kind of worldview here. I mean, Vicky wrote a couple of letters, mm-hmm, to a federal magistrate which were sort of, you know, referring to the government as Babylon, which was code for, you know, this sort of biblical sort of evil force. And that's the way they saw things. So it was really there was no choice in their own minds. I mean, if you ask Sarah today, she would explain that, you know, for us it really was a matter of survival,
yeah,
to head up there and see what happened next.
Here's Sarah Weaver from the film.
I think she was at the end of her rope. I really do. And I think for mom and dad, it was, we're not going to take anymore. You know, getting thrown in the snow and sent to jail. And if you lose your case, you lose your house. They had to have been an emotional mess.
Before we head to a break, I want to ask you, Barrack Goodman, about your conversations with Sarah. I think it's pretty remarkable that she would talk to you at all. Would you say something about that? Just your conversations with her? I mean, she's really kind of a highlight in the film, her perspective, her willingness to forgive, to be even-handed, is kind of stunning.
Sarah's one of the most remarkable people I've ever met. She's very rarely spoken about this. She has not come forward and sort of become a spokesperson for the family or for their point of view at all. In fact, she's really kept quite to herself over the years. I think the reason she came forward in this case is that she felt and has felt for a while that she's wanted to try to turn this tragedy into something positive. She just is that way. She just feels like, if she has the ability or the power or the capacity to turn something rotten and horrible and tragic in her own life into something positive for others, she'll do that. And she is so strong. She's, you know, in a place now where she quite clearly sees the flaws in the way her parents thought and the way she thought at the time, and is ready to admit that, and yet still is extremely loyal to her family and to her parents, and is quite wise about what happened, mm-hmm, and very emotional. And I think she gives one of the strongest interviews that I've ever done in my career in the film. You know, it's really almost impossible not to empathize with her and what she went through.
Barrack Goodman is with us. He directed, co-wrote, and co-produced the documentary film Ruby Ridge, which is airing tonight on the PBS series American Experience. Here in Utah, you can watch it at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. For more details and to find listings in your area, just go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a film airing on PBS stations around the country that explores the disastrous events at Ruby Ridge in northern Idaho in 1992. This was when Randy Weaver and his family were holed up in their mountaintop cabin. A firefight broke out. Weaver's wife and son were killed. So was a federal marshal. Barrack Goodman's film is kind of a cautionary tale about how at these various moments throughout the siege and the standoff, when violence could have been averted, a wrong decision was made. The film is called Ruby Ridge, and we'll give you details about when it's airing at the various places around the country. Barrack Goodman is joining us from a studio in New York City. So I want to play another moment from the film. This is the writer Jess Walter again, because it seems like there's this important theme in the film that rather than seeing people as individuals, that on both sides, they were seeing each other as caricatures, kind of demonizing them. Here's Jess Walter again from the film.
The threat assessment portrayed Randy Weaver as a former Special Forces Green Beret who may have booby-trapped his house living with the woman who would kill her own children rather than surrender. It was either worst-case scenario or fanciful, but the assessment of the Weavers made them look more like criminals and less like a family.
How important is that as a theme in this? It seems really important that they were not looking at them as a family with motivations and, you know, deeper things. They were seeing them as this thing.
Yeah, I think it's the key theme of the film. I mean, we have to remember that what happened up there, there's a context, there's a background. Not only did you have this paramilitary group called the Order running around, and some of the very federal agents who were involved in tracking that group and trying to bring them to justice were present at Ruby Ridge. You also had, early on in this confrontation, you had the killing of a federal marshal, a federal agent, which, you know, these feds are human beings. They are, even up the bureaucracy all the way to the top, when a brother in arms is killed, seemingly by a white separatist character, the alarm bells go off. And I think, you know, caution is thrown to the wind to some degree. And there's so much anger involved that it's very, very dangerous situation. It becomes, you know, almost a revenge situation, which it never should be in law enforcement, of course. But to some degree, that's what happened. And we had some very extraordinary decisions made on the part of the FBI in particular that to this day are shameful, you know, inside the FBI. But it can only be explained by regular old human emotion.
Yeah. Things really accelerate. And as someone says in the film, when a cop gets shot, cops get pissed off.
Right.
And Jess Walter talks about being, you kind of referred to it, there's another bureaucratic shift that plays out then once
right.
once a deputy, a marshal is shot, the FBI scrambles its hostage rescue team, and this is this big super SWAT team. And I want to play this in another moment here. This is Jess Walter again, and we'll hear Chuck Peterson, the defense attorney, talking about the rules of engagement kind of change at this point. Here's another moment from the film.
The hostage rescue team believe that they're deploying into an ongoing firefight with a white separatist and his armed family. Because they believe they're going into a firefight, the rationale is given that that a surrender warning doesn't need to be called out, that warning has already been given by the U.S. Marshals, deputy marshals on the ground, so agents can open fire as soon as they see any armed adult. Well, the Weavers are always armed.
They adopt a military rule of engagement. This is the enemy. You may kill them if they're armed. If they have a gun, you can and should use deadly force. That was actually the wording. You can and should use deadly force.
How unusual, how unprecedented was that?
This was the first time that kind of a rule had ever been issued in a domestic barricade situation like this. It was a warlike stance. And again, it can only be explained because of the federal marshal that had been killed in a sort of accidental firefight that had happened just before this.
Right.
Well, it bears mentioning that for all of the kind of attention on the government overreaction, we have to remember that different agencies behave differently in this case.
Yeah.
The federal marshals themselves, who inherited the case when Randy and his family refused to come to trial, actually were quite patient. There's a federal marshal we interviewed named Dave Hunt, who was on the case for 18 months trying to figure out a way to coax the Weavers off the mountain and to arrest Randy. He tried all sorts of stratagems. They set up surveillance. The tapes are in the film. They were quite patient all through a summer and a winter. And it was only when the marshals got a little too close to the cabin and there was a sort of freak accidental firefight that broke out, and Randy's son was killed, Sammy was killed, as well as a federal marshal. That's when the FBI's hostage rescue team came into the picture. They are a totally different culture, a different outfit. They are almost a paramilitary group, very heavily militarized, helicopters, assault vehicles, snipers who are highly trained. Once that happened, then things escalated quickly.
I wanted to ask you about there's the moment when – and I don't want to – I mean, I think people know the story, so it's not like we're giving things away. But I do want to let people see the film to experience some of the kind of intense drama that plays out. We should mention that Vicky is killed. And Sarah tells you about it. That's a really wrenching moment. Would you just say something about that?
Well, it is. I mean, part of the, incredible tragedy of this event is how the family was sort of exposed to each other's tragedies. I mean, this happened all up there on that ridge in a very confined geographic area. And so in the course of basically 24 hours, maybe a little longer than that, the family suffered the death of Sammy and the trauma of that. And then just the next day, with snipers surrounding them, unseen snipers, Randy is shot and wounded. A family friend named Kevin Harris, who was like a son to them and was living with them, was also shot and wounded. And Vicky was killed holding her infant daughter in her arms while Sarah was, directly next to her and describes being hit with the debris or the part of Vicky.
Yeah.
And it's almost unimaginable, the trauma. This is a 16-year-old girl. Her sister's, I think, 8 or maybe 11 at the time. She suffers the loss of her brother, her mother, and then that just begins the tragedy, because for the next 10, 11 days, they're confined to their cabin, fearful that any moment they'll be, shot themselves or, hunted down by the FBI. Their mother is lying dead under the kitchen table. It's just it's really an incredibly hard to imagine set of circumstances. And part of my admiration for Sarah is how she could take that experience, not collapse, but turn it into something where she wants to find something redemptive about it. And I think that comes through in the film.
One of the things you explore in the film is the role of the media, how there was really, at least at one point early on, there was only one version of the story, only one narrative. Here again is the writer and reporter, Jess Walter.
One of the things as a reporter that I reflect upon is the way we began reporting the story. Federal law enforcement only had one version of what was happening, and that was the way we covered the story. These are white supremacists. They are causing some trouble. There's a shootout with federal law enforcement. And the way information came out, and especially in the beginning, that was the narrative. And then the FBI discovers Samuel Weaver's body in the shed where Samuel had been taken by the family. And the story begins to shift a little bit.
Someone explains that this was government in the dark, this idea of transparency and how the story shifts. Talk about that if you would.
Well, it's a good advertisement for good old-fashioned journalism.
Yeah.
The Spokesman Review, which was the Spokane, Washington paper that Jess Walter and his colleague Bill Moreland come from, were sort of the most enterprising and the most kind of on this story. And Jess, you know, after Sammy Weaver's body was discovered by the FBI, and the FBI was keeping information very close to the vest, they were not letting – and they didn't know certain things. The FBI didn't know that Vicky had been shot and killed. There
yeah.
was a stray bullet aimed at Randy that had killed Vicky, and they didn't know she was dead. But Jess Walter decided that it wasn't enough just to kind of take in the government's press releases and press conferences, and he went to visit – the Weaver family, what remained of the Weaver family in Iowa, their relatives, and a different kind of narrative began to emerge. It wasn't clear at all that these were white supremacists. In fact, what seemed to motivate them was a kind of religious zealotry. Mm-hmm. And wait a minute, so that's not true. What else isn't true? How come we didn't know about Sammy's death? How come we're not getting details of what's going on up there? And what had been a kind of clear-cut black-and-white story of, you know, virtuous government agents, you know, trying to bring this fugitive to justice really shifted quite rapidly. And part of that shift was encouraged and engendered by protesters
right.
who began to assemble at the roadblock at the bottom of the hill, bottom of the mountain, and were, you know, essentially demanding answers from the FBI, and the press and these protesters were mingling, and the whole culture began to shift into one of, you know, extreme suspicion of what the government was doing.
We should say also that, as you mentioned, it wasn't known at that particular moment that Vicky Weaver had been killed. And just sort of to add insult to everything else, agents are basically calling to her.
Right.
And it seemed like to Sarah, to Randy, those who were there, that they were just taunting.
Here's the sort of disconnect, divide between the mental states of the two opposing forces here. Yes, I mean, the FBI negotiators, who were very well-intentioned, Jim Bodding and others, very skillful, were directing their negotiations at Vicky, because she had seemed to be sort of the leader of the family, the one who would make the decisions. Meanwhile, Vicky's lying dead on the floor in the kitchen. And of course, Sarah and Randy don't know that the FBI doesn't know that. For them, their sort of paranoid point of view, it's simply taunting. It's really just trying to rub salt in the wounds, as you said. And so this only further confirms their belief that this is the enemy. This is not a force that can be reasoned with or surrendered to. They are out to kill the family. And really, any kind of negotiation is just a ruse for that ultimate object of destroying them.
Barak Goodman is with us. He directed, co-wrote, and co-produced the documentary film Ruby Ridge, which is airing tonight on PBS stations around the country. It's the PBS series American Experience. Here in Utah, you can watch it at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. For more details and to find listings in your area, just visit our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with filmmaker Barak Goodman about his film Ruby Ridge, which is airing on the PBS series American Experience on PBS stations around the country tonight. In Utah, you can see it at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. He's joining us. Barak Goodman is from a studio in New York City. I want to play a moment from this story. This is Paul Harvey, the radio host. I'm sure everyone knows who Paul Harvey is. But I hadn't realized, or at least I guess I had forgotten, the role that he plays, at least initially. And everyone's trying to get Randy Weaver to come out of the cabin, or at least to say something. They want the FBI negotiators are wanting to talk to him. And so Paul Harvey, on his national radio broadcast, sends a message to Randy Weaver. Here it is.
A telephone has been left right outside your door on the porch. Reach out and pick it up. Nobody will shoot. Your family wants to know what to do with Samuel's body. And also, I will arrange for an attorney in Spokane to represent you in the death of Deputy Deegan with a plea of self-defense. Consider your options. I'm offering you a chance to resume the isolation you prefer with your family. If you will just reach out and pull in and talk into that portable telephone.
Man, there was that's such a surreal element to this story. Paul Harvey's getting involved.
One of many surreal elements. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, they really, the FBI was, not that the FBI engineered this, but they were quite happy it happened because they were really reaching the end of their tether here. There wasn't a lot they could do at this point short of bulldozing the cabin off the edge of the cliff. I mean, there wasn't too much to do. So, the negotiations were utterly failing. This was 3 or 4 days in. No contact had been made with Randy and the family. And there were small children in the cabin still. So what do you do?
Yeah.
It's really kind of they were at loggerheads at this point.
It's going nowhere. And then enter, talk about a surreal element, and then enter into the game, Beau Greitz.
Right.
Now, people may remember Beau Greitz, at least in the West here. He was actually a Mormon for a time and then was part of this LDS splinter group. But he was a hero to the radical right, a third-party candidate for president in 1992 at that time, and former Green Beret. He's associated with the Christian Identity Movement. Talk a little bit about Beau Greitz. He steps in and he really helps get this negotiation going.
One of the most colorful characters I've ever encountered. Rumored to be the model for the Rambo movie character. Most decorated soldier in Vietnam. An incredible career. And yes, he had become a kind of hero of the far right. He hated the government as well, and was running for president on that platform. And it's a little unclear how he first got involved. He claims the FBI came to him. The FBI says that he offered his services. In any case, he showed up at the roadblock, a kind of larger than life figure, galloping in, dominating the press, appearing before the cameras, offering his services to end this debacle. And surprisingly, the FBI took him up on it. Yeah. They sort of said, okay, let's see what you can do. So they take him up on one of these all-terrain vehicles up to the top of the ridge, park at a safe distance. He jumps off, strides right up to the edge of the cabin, plain as day, and sort of starts bellowing at Randy to please, start talking. Randy knows who Beau Greitz is. Mm-hmm. Randy's previously said Beau Greitz is one of the only people he will talk to. And they start to establish a communication. And from there, Beau is the only sort of line into the cabin and becomes, has the ability to come in and out of the cabin. And that's how this is ultimately resolved, is Beau's intervention in what was a completely, an impasse.
There's a part of the story it seems like things are just going to explode. This is when it's revealed that Vicki Weaver has been killed. And here's another moment from the film. We're going to first hear from the FBI agent in charge, Eugene Glenn, Gene Glenn. You'll also hear Beau Greitz here and the journalist, Bill Moreland.
The three children are in good health. Kevin is all right, but he did suffer a wound. Randy's in good health. Unfortunately, Vicki is dead.
The reaction was a physical gasp. For the people that had gathered, it was like a thunderclap.
Never will you take another woman down. Never!
May we die.
We're going to war! You're f***ing nothing! Don't f***ing touch me. I ain't with you.
It was horrifying. I mean, it was the first time, and we're a week into this, and now we're finding out that Randy Weaver's wife has been shot. So we now have three people dead, and the thing's still not over.
That's one thing that the film does pretty well is we see the people. I mean, they're screaming at federal officials, calling them baby killers, as you heard the intensity of that there. And it just seemed like, how is that going to resolve? It's going to end disastrously. It seems like you must have thought that, people at the time.
Yeah, these folks at the bottom of the roadblock were an interesting amalgam of just ordinary people who might have been friends with the Weavers or concerned parties, along with really far-right, extremist activists. There were skinheads there. There were people wearing Nazi uniforms and so forth. And what's important about this story beyond the kind of events themselves is its role in the rise of what we now call the alt-right, but the extremist right. It was not so much that the Weavers themselves were part of that movement, although, as I've said, they were flirting with it. Mm-hmm. But it was the symbolism of this that galvanized this group, this fairly large group of people to sort of come together with a common enemy, the federal government. And, hence was born this movement that grew and grew. It grew into something called the militia movement later on. But ultimately, in our other film, we kind of lay it at the feet of the Oklahoma City bombing. But it really was an important milestone in that in the growth of that white nationalist movement.
How deeply felt is the Ruby Ridge story today? Do you have a sense of that?
Yes, I think it's still one of those myths in the movement. It's one of those founding kind of events, along with the Branch Davidian raid and several other kind of standoffs between the government and Clive and Bundy, for example,
right,
which is now back in the news. These are touchstones for what otherwise might be a quite disparate and kind of unconnected movement. It's a way of bringing them together with a common goal and a common enemy, a founding mythology that is necessary for any movement to kind of cohere. And there are important books and tracts and pieces of literature that are also the glue. But these events are very important. They confirm for folks who are predisposed to think of the government this way. They're proof positive that they're right about the way they see the world.
What did the government learn from all of this? I'm thinking about a standoff that happened with Clive and Bundy, you mentioned, mm-hmm. not to mention what happened at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, when the government basically didn't do anything. And there was a critique that maybe they should do something,
right.
But it seems like this is one of the lessons that they learned.
Without question, these two events that I mentioned, Ruby Ridge and the Branch Davidian standoff in Waco, Texas, taught the FBI, and by the way, it was very much the same folks, the hostage rescue team at both events, both standoffs. It really taught the FBI the lesson that you cannot try to precipitate an actual conflict, an actual clash. You have to simply wait it out. You have to be patient. In Waco, they waited 51 days, and some would argue that that was plenty of time, to wait it out and nothing was going to happen. That may be true. But internally, inside the FBI, the takeaway was don't do anything to precipitate a crisis. Sit back. They're not going anywhere. If you have to, throw up some fencing around it. Whatever it takes, just wait it out. And in subsequent events, there was a standoff with a militia in Montana that lasted 90 days. There have been subsequent, as you point out, the standoff in Oregon, they resisted pressure to go in and try to do something. And that's part of it. The press, even the public, want these folks out. They don't want this to continue. But the federal law enforcement has decided to withstand that pressure. It's a lesser evil than to wind up with dead people on your hands or dead federal agents on your hands.
I want to play one more moment from the film. This is a really powerful moment. This is Sarah Weaver who has, I guess she's forgiven the federal agents involved. And in the film, she says a remarkable thing about the dangers of creating these stereotypes.
I do know there's a lot of remorse. And I know the FBI uses what happened to my family as a training tool as to what not to do. And that is hugely gratifying to me. But the same way they stereotyped my dad and blew him up into this thing that he wasn't, I think a lot of people do that with our government as well. And when you operate out of misinformation and fear, things can go wrong.
It seems like you should have a bumper sticker printed out that says that, right? I mean, it's a really powerful thing to say.
Yeah, particularly from her, yeah. You know, who's really felt the tangible effects of that kind of stereotyping and misinformation. And, you know, again, I mean, it is for me the lesson of this story and subsequent events at Waco and Oklahoma City that we're not blaming the federal government for these things. Far from it. It's you know, there's plenty of blame to pass around. But if you want to learn something from it, it has to be that we lump. We're too prone to sort of lumping people into kind of buckets. And in federal law enforcement, the bucket was threat, terrorist, domestic terrorist threat must be dealt with in the following ways: violently, you know, suppressed. And we forget that this was a family of people with a certain point of view and a certain perspective that needed to be treated with a lot more grace and understanding.
Barrack Goodman directed, co-wrote, and co-produced the documentary film Ruby Ridge, airing tonight on the PBS series American Experience. You can see it here in Utah at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. Barrack Goodman, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.